prepared. Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. So it's my pleasure to introduce to you this this work that we did recently on the honeycomb lattice using quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And what I will try to do is to give you a little bit of a flavor of why this is now somewhat advanced to what you could have done, let's say, 20 years ago, and also to show you some of the details of the data and various other measurements that we did after the publication. So the people involved here, first of all, my student Xiang Meng, who is in the audience, and actually I'm going to leave to Boulder later today around noon, so if there's any questions coming up about details, you can you can really ask Xiang for any detail about the data, or if you need, you know, if you have a suggestion, you can also discuss that with him. Then Alexander Muamatsu was also involved in this, so both from the University of Stuttgart. And then we have also Farag Asad and his student Thomas Lang from the Würzburg University participating strongly in this numerical study. And so what I will try to do is, first of all, to motivate a little bit why we have been looking at this specific situation, and then show you the results. So the model that we look at is the Planard-Harbaugh model. And actually, what I present here will be for a two species case. Yeah, so we have only spin up and spin down. But we have also looked at an extension towards SUN generalizations. And actually, Facker will come here, I think, in 2 weeks, and he will give a second talk in this series, one where he will focus on these SUN generalizations. Maybe some of you know that Facker has some work on SUN. Type Harbaugh models on the square lattice, and so this, you know, is like a step from the square lattice to honeycomb lattice. Okay, and also Alexander Muamatsu and Thomas Lang, they will also be actually coming next week, so there's a lot of time to discuss maybe some of the issues. And this model is, I don't really have to introduce it in any detail. The point is that if you go to large U, you would expect to see some antiferromagnetic exchange. And so there's a tendency towards antiferromagnetic order in that model. And if you look, for example, on the square lattice, then if you start that model at U equals zero and you calculate, for example, the magnetic susceptibility for a spin density wave, actually turns out that there are two issues. First of all, you have Fermi surface nesting, which gives you one logarithmic divergence, but then there's another logarithmic divergence for antiferromagnetic order because of the Van Hove singularity that you have the density of states. And so that triggers antiferromagnetic long-range order at wave vector pi pi immediately as soon as U is finite. Yeah, so that's really like a Stoner instability, and then it crosses over to a kind of Neel type antiferromagnetic order for large U. But on square lattice, then there would be the critical U towards antiferromagnetic instability is zero. Now, I don't want to talk here about, which I would usually do at this point, talk about frustrated systems and the notion of spin liquid, because we have heard various nice, very nice talks about this kind of general setting, in particular Jeff's talk last week. So I'm going to skip that. I'm going to really jump to the honeycomb lattice. And the honeycomb lattice, of course, it's not frustrated. So the antiferromagnetic order is not frustrated. So in that respect, this is a little surprising to find a spin liquid there, you might say. So what's different in the honeycomb lattice? Well, there are a few things different. First of all, it has actually two sides per unit cell. So the antiferromagnetic state can reside within the unit set. So there's no translational symmetry breaking if you form the antiferromagnet. It's just rotational symmetry break. So, the next thing is that if you look at the band structure, then you'll know there are the specific points K and K prime at the corner of the brilliant zones where the dispersion and non-interacting model becomes linear. But furthermore, the density of states actually vanishes exactly at this point. So if you have the half-filled system, you have like a semi-metal and with a density of states that vanishes, and so all these instability towards antiferromagnetic order are suppressed by that very fact. So if you then ask what happens if I have a finite U, then because of this absence of the Van Hove singularity, and in particular the vanishing of the density of states, the antiferromagnetic order does not start immediately. So in the early days, let's say, starting in the early 90s, people have already looked at this problem. There's this nice paper by Tosati and Sorella, where people have done Monte Carlo simulations, actually a very similar flavor that we did, and they argued that there's a direct quantum phase transition between the semi-metal and the anti-fermionic mode insulator at a critical value of U, which is around 4.5, but at that time, this has an error bar of plus minus 0.5 if you want, so that was not very precise, you know, and this is kind of a common picture of what would happen. But then in this century,
so were they finding second order?
That's hard to say from all these. Also, if I show you the data, if the transition is second order, first order, it's somewhat not easy to say, but things look continuous. Okay. So now there's a whole new kind of business about Hubbard models driven by graphene and by topological insulators. So now you can ask, is that really the picture that holds, or is there something in between? And there were these papers like from Lee and also from Mike Hermely, that there might be in the vicinity of the mod transition some spin liquid phase. But the spin liquid phase that these authors here propose is a gapless spin liquid. Whereas the spin liquid that I will present to you later is actually a gap spin liquid. So that's not this phase, right? But then there's also, if you go away from the plain simple Hubbard model and you put like explicit, let's say, doping or some extended interactions, or you add spin orbit coupling, I mean, there's all these very nice work of new phases like superconductivity, charge density waves of different flavors, or some quantum anomalous or quantum spin Hall states. So if we ever find something between the semi-metal and the anti-fermionic mode insulator, we felt urged to check all these order parameters and see if they're actually there or not, right? So that makes the problem a little bit tedious. If you find something and you would like to know what it is, you have to check a lot of different proposals and exclude them. All right. So the method that we use is, as I already said, it's a Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo. It's a projective approach using auxiliary field decoupling, which actually goes back to work done in Pasadena in 86. So that's kind of the first paper on this general type of approach towards really sampling the ground state wave function, approaching the ground state wave function of that system. So this is not a finite temperature method, but it's really aiming at obtaining ground state expectation values. So what you try, or what you do is, and sorry, this is a nice recent review of this method, and Farquhar Assad is of course one of the very prominent figures in this type of quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And so what you start is from a reasonable peak trial wave function. So that means that you would start from a trial wave function which in particular incorporates all the good quantum numbers that you know. Like, for example, from the leap theorem, we know that this has to be a singlet state, so we start from a singlet state. Otherwise, you have to project out a lot of other states, which makes the simulation less efficient. So you have to pick a good trial wave function which has a non-zero overlap with the true ground state at finite u. And then what you do is you apply your Hamiltonian, imagine your time evolution operator, to project out the true ground state. So in a sense, that's a projective approach. And then you can sample various observables, and you will see examples of how that works later. So the nice thing is that this method is sign problem free, in particular on bipartite lattices at half filling. And so in terms of computational resources, what we could push to is to do systems which contain 2 times L squared sides, where L went up to 18 for the results that we published, and later we also did some simulations for 21, and in order to verify the if the new values lie on the extrapolation lines that we have drawn in the paper, right?
When you say that in particular on the bipartite lattices at half filling, what do you mean? Only on those, or
no? I mean this method. If you go to positive U, you can do other cases as well. For positive U, you can, for example, go away from half filling.
Negative.
For negative U, yes. Sorry, of course, yeah. Yeah. So.
For negative view, I mean.
Yeah. For negative view, you can do any filling actually. There's yeah.
Stefan, you sure. Cannot put any quantum numbers because otherwise, also, our feeling if you can solve the finite SZ sector would be equivalent to solving the repulsive case away from our feeling. You know, so you have to work with a singlet wave function, I guess.
Mm-hmm. For a negative view or
even for attractive view here, you have to fix to have a singlet wave.
Yeah.
But if you were able also to sample all the spin sectors, then you know you have transformation from positive view to attractive view. So
yeah, sure.
Field maps to doping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But can you make a statement about how unbiased you are? So how independent of the travel function are you going to be in the end?
How could you check that? You would have to start with another trail wave function, I guess, right? And then see that you converge to the same results. We didn't do that, but I guess the general idea is that if you allow for the right, if you're in the right symmetry sector, then you know the projection is supposed to work. I mean, I don't see where you could go.
Well, we have many examples when people cannot reproduce the same answers using another trail.
I see. Then we should maybe check another trail wave function. Yeah. I mean, there's some problems where some issues like topological degeneracy, where in principle one could imagine starting with different trail wave functions. But as soon as and you will see that later. If you start with a trail wave function that does not include some of the symmetries, also your algorithm can become very much inefficient because you need much longer projection times.
But even within the same symmetries, you might have different
shapes. Yeah, one simple thing you could do is you could just use a Hartree fork instead of the UQ0.
As long as there's overlap with the ground state, you're guaranteed to get the right answer.
Even for bosons,
people claim exact calculation using exact method. Next year, they change the answer and ultimately completely reverse.
It's a formal statement. It's a question of whether you've projected model.
What we monitor usually is we monitor the observables as a function of a projection parameter, right? And if we see conversion, then that's I think the best you can do. I mean, you can of course start with a different trail wave function, but if that just makes your projection length significantly longer, it wouldn't really help because then you're not sure if you actually compare.
How do you know that you hit the right one? Maybe you're already kind of suffering for the long one, and the other one will converge even faster. You just selected one particular trial function.
Yes.
How do you know the other one will be worse or better? Maybe
if you don't try, you don't know. Yeah.
You can somehow assume that any other will be worse.
Yeah, for this problem, the kind of projection length that we actually found is not that bad. I mean, if you go like to ribbons, we're studying ribbons now, the projection length is like a factor of 20 larger that you need. So maybe there one should consider different trial wave functions. Okay, so let me just say a few words about this method. I mean, how are we doing in time? Well, so what you do is you decouple your propagation, your imaginary time propagation operator by a Trotter-Suzuki-Dern composition. There are different flavors of this. So we use one that if you look at the integrated one, gives you a delta tau squared error, and then you have to. So this is the interaction part here. You have to decouple that with a Haber-Stratonowicz transformation, and there are various ways of doing that. And the one that is implemented in Fokker's code is actually a one which is SU2 invariant. So that's based on this almost equality here or this equation. This value L here is actually 4. It's not 2 like for an easing spin, but it takes on 4 values, which are, and then this functions gamma here and eta take on the specific values, and you can show that, you know, that the exponential here is equal to that up to an error which goes as delta tau to the power 4. So that's for each step here, and so if you integrate over imaginary time, then you get an error which is of order delta tau to the power 3. But that's still smaller than the Trotter error you have in the first place, so that's why this doesn't really bother you, right? But the advantage of this type of decoupling is that it's, as you can see, it's explicitly SU2 invariant. And so you don't have to restore SU2 symmetry. If you do other type of Haber-Stratonowicz decoupling and you work with the standard one for repulsive Hubbard models, you would have to restore the SE2 symmetry during a simulation, which actually is very costly. And now the trial wave function. So what we choose is we look at the non-interacting system, and then we take the ground state, which is then of course this later determinant, and that's also our wave function that we used, right? And in principle one could try different ones, but we didn't. So then, how do you proceed? Well, if you integrate out the fermions at that point, you get statistical weights with their fermionic determinants. And so, as I said before, you can convince yourself that you actually get squares of these determinants, and so there's no sign problem if there's particle hole symmetry. And so far, so good. So this is kind of standard. But then there was this paper in 2001 by Martin Feldbach and Fakhar Asser where they showed how to really do efficient measurements of dynamical correlation functions. So not just static observable, but really like the Green's function, imaginary time, and also spin-spin correlation function, which up to that paper were rather costly, but they really managed to do that very efficiently with some simple ideas, actually. And so that is all implemented in this code, of course. And so now in terms of convergence, what we monitored is that if the projection parameter theta, maybe I show that again what that is. This is like an inverse temperature, but it's not really a temperature. It's more like a projection parameter theta. If theta is of the order of 40 divided by t for the represent U range that we have, then we observe convergence of all results. And then you still have to deal, so this is not a continuous time method, it's still discrete time, and then you still have to worry about the Trotter errors. And what we observed is that if you once you go below this kind of value for delta tau, then the statistical errors dominate, and then you can just sample longer. Okay. And now this is this is the central slide of the talk, and the rest of the talk will just be kind of a justification of our statement. So this is the phase diagram as we propose it. So this is U over T, and there's actually just one parameter that we vary. This is U over T, right? So, and the color of these plots are maybe a little bit irritating, but it's just to highlight the different features. I mean, this is just like the staggered magnetization shown on this axis, and here are some various gaps, like the single particle gap and the spin gap. So let's walk through that. So this is the blue line here, that's the single particle gap. And as you can see, we can talk in a second of how to get that. Once U is beyond 3.6, we have a clear finite single particle gap. And this is actually the smallest gap in the system at the K point. So that's the single particle gap here. And the antiferromagnetic order, if you extrapolate that, it sets on like around 4.3. Yeah. So at this point, then you have the antiferromagnetic order. But in between that, then there's a single particle gap, but no staggered order parameter. But if you look at the spin gap, you observe that there's this dome where the spin gap is finite, just between the semi-metal and the antiferromagnetic. Now I get frequently this question. Let's see. So the question that I many times get is, well, you kind of see that here there is a finite spin gap at 3.6, but the single particle gap is essentially zero. But that's not really true. That's maybe a problem here, because the spin gap here is multiplied by a factor of 6. So I have to think it by a factor of 6 smaller, but still you would say, well, this is most likely finite, but this is most likely zero. But I mean, there's a problem here with the statistical error. So I think we are conservative here, but where it exactly opens is hard to tell. But at least, let's say around 4, we have both gaps finite.
Is it easy to understand why you get such bigger error bars for the spin gap than for the
If you look at if you do the Wick decomposition, then you see how many Green's function actually go into your measurement, and that's just the 2 times for the spin correlator. Yeah, so the spin correlator has just more statistical noise. And let's look at the data. Okay, so the first quantity is the single particle gap, which we measure from looking at the imaginary time behavior of the Green's function. And we in particular look at the Green's function at the K point here, where the Dirac cones are located. So that's where you have no gap if you are at small u. And in the inset, what you see is at the specific value of u over t equal to 4, which will be showing up again and again, because that's kind of our reference point where we think we are really in that phase, in that intermediate phase. And as a function of linear system size, the behavior of the imaginary time displaced Green's function, and from the slope of that line, see, you can extract the gap, the single particle gap. And for L equal to 3, we compared this also to excitation, which was provided by Sylvain Caponi at some point to Parker, and so we could nicely compare, and it agrees. So then here's your finite size scaling, and this is another issue. I mean, if you have to do finite size scaling, you have to assume some sort of finite size scaling behavior. But if you're given this data here, there's, I think, no really reason to go away, at least in the range of system sizes that we have from a linear scaling. And then if you do that, you see that the charge gap starts to open around 3.6. Whereas for smaller values of u, it is approaches zero.
But why are we supposed to expect a linear scaling in a gap sense?
Well, I guess at some point there will be here an exponential behavior, but we just don't see that.
So we should probably assume that the gaps that you're plotting
are larger.
Estimating the true gap.
Yes, exactly. Well, the true gap would be larger.
But even for those u's which are deep in the phase and where the gap is bigger than, you know, those u's where you're at the polar phase, there's no difference in the finite size behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
No visible term or anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, we sort of estimated from the spins in the spin sector that you would have to have system sizes larger than L equal 40 to see this type of, you know, that you're really in the range where you are beyond the correlation lengths. But that's not a fact of 8 times the correlation lengths yet. So I think we cannot never really get there without the super tricks at this point. I mean, that's what we can do, right?
But if you really go larger, you if you take 10 or what, can you see some exponential saturation?
Well, how far are we here? I don't know. Do you remember if we have? Yeah, we can look at that.
Yeah. I think we can see some curve, but I'm not sure. We can check. We go up to u equals 8.
Yeah. We can check that. Okay, so the next order is the order parameter, right, for the antiferromagnetic order. So we do two things. So first of all, let me discuss the structure factor. So this is, okay, I mean, this is clear, right? It's Q equals zero, but it's antisymmetric within the unit cell. So you have SA, this is, anyway, that's the right structure factor. And so this is plotted here as a function of 1 over L for different values of U over T. And again, you see you have to do finite size extrapolation, and the thing is not that straightforward as before, because there's definitely some curvature, so we have to play with higher polynomials. And so the motivation why I think we can still do that is there's rather nice work by Anders Sandvik, of course, for the Heisenberg model, which has strong antiferromagnetic order, on similar system sizes. And using the conventional fitting formulas, he got very precise values that are later have also been found by, let's say, Steve White with DMIG on 2D. So that's the kind of scaling we use, so the conventional scaling for the order parameter and one powers of 1 over L. But there's a statistical error here, and we should take care of that. So we do bootstrapping. So we sample not only the mean value that we find, but we really sample within this range of the error bar. And that's what's shown here in the inset. So in the inset is shown a histogram of the extrapolated values of the order parameter square in the thermodynamic limit for different values of u. Yeah? And so, for example, here at 4.5, you have a clear peak, which is clearly finite. And at 4.3, you are within the error margin, I mean, you're essentially at finite values, but at 4.0, you are still at zero, right? So there's antiferromagnetic order beyond 4.3 from this analysis. Okay. And the other way to look at the spin-spin, at the spin correlations, is to really measure the spin-spin correlations and the furthest available distance that you have on your finite lattice. And that is shown in this plot here, one for u equal 4 and one for 4.5. So you can either measure the correlation for two sites furthest distance away in the same sublattice, like AA, or in the different sublattice. So that gives you, actually combined then with a plot of the structure factor divided by n, gives you three different curves that essentially should converge to the same result in the thermodynamic limit. And they do that, both at u equals 0, where they go to 0, and at 4.5, where they both go to the common finite value. So this is independent fits here, and they agree. Yeah, up to cubic order.
Excuse me.
Yeah, sure.
During the Dale phase, the if we go back to the say S antiferromagnetic, there are also some constraints on what the linear term should be, right, in terms of other correlation functions that are known from Daniel Fisher and many others. So I don't know if Sandvik has checked his, but have you checked yours?
I mean. Yeah, I think spin wave velocity enters the spin stiffness, so we could get the spin velocity, but the spin stiffness will. We have to see how we can do that.
Well, but it should be long wavelength.
Should be generic.
Thing, it should be true for any model as long as you're in the Nail phase.
Yeah.
Well, that's if 4.5 is not really well into the Nail phase.
The Dale phase.
Yeah.
It's an insulator. So probably the first leading term should be in one of our L square.
Right.
After that, you have L equal to one of our L power three of our R.
Yeah, but that's a maybe interesting thing to compare. Yeah. Okay. Well, then the next observable, which is made of decisive, I guess, is the gap to the spin excitation. So what we measure the spin-spin correlation function imaginary time, and they're at the gamma point in the antisymmetric sector, right, which is kind of, you know, where you would expect to see the Goldstone mode for large U. So this should vanish for large U, and it should vanish for small U in the semi-metal. And a generic feature of this quantity, the finite size spin gap, is actually that it always shows a bump at intermediate system size. Like look at L equals 6, so the, you know, at U equals 0 there's no spin gap on the finite system, so that quantity has to go to 0. And at large U, all the energy scales that are connected to spin physics go like T squared over U, so like J proportion T squared over U, so everything should scale as 1 over U. So that this quantity, actually, the spin gap, for example, then also scaling with J for large U, has to come up from somewhere being small in the finite system and increasing. And in order for it to go back to zero, it has to go through a maximum. Right? So that's a very generic feature. You also find that on the square LED. So seeing a maximum is something that has to be there. Now, the non-trivial part is how does this maximum move as you increase system size. And if we look, for example, on the square lattice, now that's for the bilayer. I will talk later a little bit on bilayer if there's time. I guess not. You see that this maximum actually moves as a function of systems that moves towards U equals zero. But here it doesn't. Here it really stays in this range here around 4. And if you then do an extrapolation, it goes to a finite value. And this is the data. And that's what I control, right? I mean, I cannot do more. So maybe the most important point is U equals 4. And this is the green points. And now you can say, well, maybe there's something happening at really larger that it has a curvature, but we don't see that. So doing the...
May I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
For the larger system size, I see a gap such that gap times theta is a 41. How do you know your projection time is enough? If your projection time is comparable to
that's a good question, and that has to do with the fact that we are really having a singlet tri-wave function. If we would not have a singlet tri-wave function...
But you cannot project out any of the states which are, say, smaller than inverse theta, by the nature of what you do.
No, we can.
Because your theta is not enough.
See, this is in the triplet sector, right? This gap. And the energies that show up doing the projection that we have to overcome are all in the singlet sector. Yeah, I mean, if that would not be the case, then we would be screwed at this point. I completely agree. If we would start with a tri-wave function that has a finite overlap with the triplet sector, we would have to project even further. Yes. Okay, so now comes the part of the talk that, depending on your flavor, some people find boring, others find interesting. It's kind of excluding all the different types of order. So what is that phase? So one, you could ask, well, let's say look at density-density correlation functions, and you know, this is like looking at the density correlation from 2 points at our furthest distance away, but they rapidly decay to zero at Euclid 4. Then you can look at superconductivity, and we did two things. One was for threading the system with a finite flux and looking for tunneling barriers, like flux quantizations. And so in this type of plots, where this is the flux divided by the flux quantum, which in this case is h divided by e and not by 2e, you would actually, as you know, this is the energy difference between, you know, a system with a certain flux and just 1/2 flux quantum. And if there would be superconductivity, you would actually expect to see some kind of bump here emerging for large systems. And for example, Fakker and Scalapino have done a simulation of this type and the attractive Howard model, and you nicely see that. So here for the repulsive model on the honeycomb lattice, the results at Euclid 0 and at Euclid 4, even though the error bars at Euclid 4 are definitely larger, do not indicate the presence of flux quantization. So, but then you also can measure the pair-pair correlation functions explicitly. What we did is we looked at how can we get SPD or F-wave pairing, and so building on either nearest neighbor or next nearest neighbor pairing. And so then we measured this pair-pair correlation function, both for nearest neighbor and for next nearest neighbors on the furthest distance, and all these correlation functions very rapidly go to zero. So at half filling, we don't see superconductivity. Now this is maybe more interesting. This is the dimer-dimer correlation function in the spin sector. So this here is our reference bond, and then we measure this correlation function here, which kind of is a projection on singlets throughout the lattice. And as you can see, there's a certain pattern here in the hexagons just next to that side, but then this signal dies off sufficiently fast so that there's a really short range. And there's also in the dynamical correlation function of this type, you see a gap. Lodi, you don't look very happy. I don't know. Okay? then if you compare the signal around the hexagon to an isolated for a six-ring Hubbard chain at the same value of u, you first of all see that the generic pattern agrees. And if you look at the wave function here, it's almost an RVB. I mean, there's a large overlap for large u with an RVB resonating state. So that we would say is that we have short-range dimer-dimer correlations with a spatial pattern that is somewhat characteristic of an RVB phase. And that's what we can say at this point, really. Now you can look at all the bond correlation functions in the charge sector, like kinetic energy correlations or current correlations, or even look at spin currents. We also did that, and there are these plots where you can, you know, see that all these kind of correlation functions really are not there. Now this is a very simple observable, which is just the kinetic energy, and the kinetic energy shows actually two features. So what we do is we take the derivative, so the kinetic energy itself is shown here in the inset, but then if you take the derivative of the kinetic energy, then you can connect this to perturbation theory. And for example, for small u, you have this characteristic positive slope of the derivative of the kinetic energy. And then for large u, so in the mod phase, in the antimagnetic phase, you have a negative slope here. But then you see that, so that the change of slope is around it's somewhere here around 4.3, you know, somewhere where we see that antiferromagnetic order sets in. But then, sorry, if you look a little bit earlier, like starting at 3 point something, you already see that you have a departure from this slope. So the slope in this regime is different from the one here. So which you can take as some indication that there, even if we don't know precisely what is the phase, at least there's some new regime. Okay. Now the question about topological degeneracy. Actually, was a paper in June by Tao Li from Beijing, who was arguing that on general grounds you would actually not expect to see any topological degeneracy, which comes from the fact that we have here two atoms per unit cell, and but still at that time we were trying to see if there's topological degeneracy. So how could we in principle detect it? Well, this goes back to the question that we have asked earlier. So you have to look how, for example, does the energy scale, the expectation value of the energy, scale with the projection parameter. And this is shown here as a function, for L equal 12. So this is the energy. And you see, at some point you within the error bar, you hit your converged value. And so you can kind of say, where does this happen? So this happens, for example, here between at projection parameter between 5 and 6. So the actual simulations we did way here. But you can already, because you have to also look at other observables, but the energy converges rather quickly. And this is related to the fact that given this, that it converges so quickly, you would say that there is no low-lying singlet state that we have to overcome. We essentially projected out all a low-lying singlet state, excited singlet state at this projection parameter. And so then you can do an extrapolation of this kind of value of T star, theta star, where you have converged. This is not very, you have to deal with all these issues of like, how do you actually resolve that precisely because there are statistical errors. But if you do that, then this is the extrapolation of 1 over L, and it really goes to a value which is finite. So that, first of all, tells you that from the simulation point of view, we are lucky that we don't have a low energy singlet state, because otherwise we would have to project much larger. And second, you see that this scale is really much larger than the singlet excitation's energy that we measure. But that's no problem, because they are not mixed into the tri-wave function, so we don't have to project them out. Yes?
You mean the other one was the triplet, not singlet?
This one is the triplet, yes?
Yeah, you said singlet.
Oh, did I say singlet? Sorry. No, this is the triplet one. Yes. Mm-hmm.
There could be a lower energy singlet excitation that
in another sector, yes.
Yes.
But once seeing that paper here, we kind of thought that, well, maybe we don't have to look for it because it is expected not to be there.
The paper is right.
You know that the paper is right? I don't know. I didn't understand what you
said. I just said not every paper is right.
That's true, but it seemed to be convincing to me.
Stefan, can you also obtain the singlet gap from dynamical singlet observables?
Well, I don't know how to get exactly this one, the lowest one. I can take any correlation function like the spin-spin or singlet-singlet, I can get, yes, I can get one. But I'm not sure if that's the lowest one, right? Who knows which operator you have to take to really get the lowest one. So I guess this is a conservative estimate of the lowest one.
In principle, at twice the triplet gap, you can have singlet. You can take two triplet excitation from a singlet. So it seems to be too high from the singlet gap.
That's a good point. You can also look, for example, in the uniform spin sector, right, that we also looked at. And there you see an excitation which is like two times the triplet. Now, this is really, this is like just, this more, I would actually see this more as assuring that the simulations don't go gaga. Right?
May I ask a naive question?
Sure. So
you cannot make a singlet out of two triplet excitations?
You can. Yeah, that's what we just discussed.
And you don't see it?
We don't see that one here, no.
No, you can.
You can see that if you look at the uniform spin-spin correlation function, yes. And then you see that this is an energy which is twice the energy of this triplet. But with this kind of gross approach, we cannot resolve that. So maybe this is really more targeting the fact that we project sufficiently fast. Now, then there was this issue, are there spin pneumatic type of order? So what we did is we looked at these two specific order parameters. So this is like, so you go into your unit cell and you take, the spin on sublattice AX and spin on sublattice BY, and you look at that correlation function. So some people call that an N-type pneumatic, spin pneumatic, and that really dies off very quickly. This is at Euclid 4, sorry, that's not written anywhere here. Or you can look at the cross product between these two spin operators, and also that one, which some people call the P-type spin pneumatic, also goes away very quickly. let me maybe stop at this point. I don't have to talk about this. And so the conclusions from my side would be that it is rather clear that, and that was actually known before, that you need finite repulsion to induce the Mohr transition on the Hubbard on the honeycomb lattice. Then we find that in the vicinity of the Mohr transition, there's a non-magnetic phase, which to us appears to be like a short-range RVB scenario. So then you could of course ask, does superconductivity arise from that upon doping? But the open question, and we unfortunately at this point did not contribute significantly more to that question, is what is the precise nature of that phase and why should it be there, right? And so there's this is a summary of theoretical papers that came out after our submission, which target this question. And the last paper here by Tengao Wen's group came out yesterday or today on the archive. So I don't know if Cenk is on various of these papers, and I'm very happy that he will talk about now all, or at least some of the proposals. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention. And please keep in mind that there are other people always coming, like Alejandro and Thomas and Faka. So if within the next few weeks you still have questions, you're almost welcome to ask. And if you have a suggestion of what we should measure, or how should we improve, or simulation, that would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much.
This is more along, I don't, sort of a question, but more along the lines of a suggestion. It looks like, you know, you've measured a huge fraction of things that you could probably measure for this model, but maybe it's be worthwhile to explore other models that might have similar properties or extensions of this one.
That's a good.
But, I mean, for instance, so the general idea that we have a bipartite model that has a Mott transition that can be simulated without a sign problem, you can ask, you know, what class of Hamiltonians of that type can one come up with, right? So seems to me there's a simple one which broadens this one, which is if you anything with Dirac points will have a stable semi-metallic phase, basically just by phase space or small u. And so another one which is very well known is the high flux square lattice.
We actually plan to do that.
And actually, you can interpolate between the honeycomb and the high flux by just putting some negative sign bond in there. Then you have a parameter,
That's on my list of things.
On your list, okay. Yeah.
But, you know, moving to Aachen, of course, there will be a little gap in kind of getting the group moving on, and maybe other people are fast. But there was a paper by, maybe you remember?
I think Professor Ho from Beijing.
Ho from Beijing, yes. Who actually looking with a nonlinear sigma model approach on both this honeycomb lattice and the pi flux model. And for the pi flux model, their phasogram looks, from the topology, looks very similar. There's an intermediate phase. But for the honeycomb lattice, which would be more close to what we do, actually they find that there's further phases. Like in their approach, you go from semi-metal to antiferromagnet, then you go to spin liquid, then you go back to the antiferromagnet. So that seems to be not that close to what we find. But for the pi flux model, their phasogram is at the same topology as here. So it would be really nice to check on that.
But, you know, no analytical theorist has control of it. It's all speculative.
That's good to hear.
You do that. I'm going to talk about something uncontrolled.
Okay.
Can you show the dimer correlation functions again?
Yes, sure. I hate doing that, but computer's so freaking out. Here we go.
So, I mean, just based on the signs, can you say anything about possibly what kind of, if there's a dimerized phase, what?
I mean, a long range dimerization pattern or?
Well, short range, let's say.
Well, I mean, what we tried, we saw that the larger signal is within the hexagon itself, and so that you can compare to an isolated hexagon. So that has the same pattern. So and if you look at the wave function of an isolated six-side ring, it has an RVB ground state almost to like 96% fidelity.
Just to comment on that, we have wave functions that give at least the sign of that pattern, although it's a spin model, and so things are a little bit different. For any sort of algebraic spin liquid and/or Z2, spin liquid tends to have patterns that look very much like this.
Maybe let me say that actually Brian will give a talk on his results after. I mean, so there will be another session where first Farco will talk and then Brian will talk about his results. So that actually has a pattern where the phases match, that the signs match of ours, but it's long range. Yeah.
I guess one should look beyond the first hexagon, though, right?
We match everything.
Oh, you match
sign in that whole picture.
But see, the problem here is that these values actually become essentially zero very quickly. So then.
But they are significant. I mean, it's non-zero within.
Some are. Yeah, some are.
Orders aren't.
Some are, but not all. Yeah, yeah.
But maybe I have a comment about this type of flux. I mean, if you put spinnacle there, I mean, suppose there's spinnacle there, so you have to go through all this possible checking null process.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Only.
A lot of work. Yeah. Doing work. Infinitely more work to add another parameter.
No, my point is that this is not. You can never complete this process. I mean, when people come up, maybe a new symmetry breaking or something.
Well, but maybe you find, instance, by adding another parameter, a range where at least the gaps are bigger, it's more clear, and then you'd have a point to focus on. Or you see a phase transition. It'll allow you to piece together pictures. Is this a generic thing, is it common? Simpler scenario occurring for other models in this class. We learn a lot, even without really the process of ruling out an infinite number of order parameters taking an infinite amount of time. But on your finite lattice, presumably you run out of grad students.
Well, one should say that there was a paper by Murdy and collaborators who actually classified all the possible symmetry break on a midfield level, the possible symmetry breaking order parameters that you could have, and I think we exhausted all their list.
It's for fermion bilinear, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, number of parameters.
Yes, bilinear. I know, maybe. Because I have to take the plane also, maybe.
So let's thank Gershon again.